You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to human rights and international law. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining me today. I'm Katie, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we will be talking about Ireland's direct provision system. This system has been in place in the country since 2000 to provide accommodation to asylum seekers, and it has faced significant attention of late following the government's announcement in December that they would no longer be able to guarantee accommodation to single male asylum seekers arriving in Ireland. This is due to a lack of available accommodation spaces in the country. In this podcast, we will look at issues direct provision has faced since its inception, efforts to change the system, some of the recent challenges surrounding the provision of accommodation for asylum seekers in the country, and where we can go from here to better support those seeking asylum in Ireland. Joining me today is Dr. Kira Smith, who is Programme Director of the LLM in International Migration and Refugee Law and Policy at the Irish Centre for Human Rights, University of Galway. Kira has also worked for a number of non-governmental and intergovernmental organisations in Ireland and abroad, including the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She was previously Vice Chair of the Board of the Irish Refugee Council, and topically for today's discussion was a member of the McMahon Working Group on Direct Provision. Kira, thanks so much for being here and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Katie. Pleasure to be here.
So just to get us started with some of the basics of the direct provision system in Ireland. So the system started in 2000, my understanding is, to provide temporary accommodation for asylum seekers arriving in the country. And the government essentially contracted private entities, which were often hotels or B&Bs, to provide this accommodation. But despite the fact that this system was supposed to be temporary, it's continued until today. And, you know, my initial thoughts when I started researching this subject was that, in general, it seemed like a positive. The government had a system in place to provide accommodation for asylum seekers. Coming from the Canadian context, we don't have that same kind of direct provision of any accommodation. We also have a lot of issues with asylum seekers being homeless. So initially I thought, oh, that's a good thing. And then the deeper I went into the issue, kind of realized there were more and more problems with it. So for those who aren't familiar with it, who might think similarly to me, you know, if they're just looking at the issues as like a overall, you know, basic view, what were some of the concerns that there were with the direct provision system early on that, you know, you saw or colleagues saw?
Okay, well, maybe I'll start by just outlining some of the features of direct provision, which, as you say, was introduced in 2000. And the introduction of it was interesting as well, because actually it mimicked the introduction of a similar system in the UK just 2 years previous to that. So often what you'll find is that Irish asylum policy and practice mimics what happens in the UK, possibly because we share a common travel area with the UK, and there's a concern, there always has been a concern, that whatever happens in the UK ought also to be reflected in Ireland. Otherwise, this could be a so-called pull factor for asylum seekers from the UK to Ireland. So they introduced a system similar to direct provision, and then we introduced ours in 2000. Another reason also was the housing crisis that was in Dublin in 2000 at that time. So it was supposed to be a temporary system, lasting probably no longer than 6 months initially, and then to be replaced by something else. But that replacement never came. So what are the features of direct provision? Well, the first thing is that direct provision is a dispersed system of reception for asylum seekers. So asylum seekers don't remain in Dublin, even though most asylum seekers would start off in Dublin, and that's where the asylum agencies are. They're dispersed all around the country to a variety of settings, which could be hotels, hostels, caravan sites, camping sites, where they're accommodated in congregated settings. So it's kind of institutionalized congregated asylum accommodation. And that lasts for as long as the asylum seeker is in the asylum system. So they essentially get bed and board and a weekly allowance. So it's a kind of a largely cashless system. The weekly allowance is supposed to be just for sort of kind of sundries. They're excluded from the social welfare system. Until relatively recently, they were denied the right to work. Also, children, although they could attend primary and second level education, they couldn't go on to third level until quite recently. So they were effectively excluded from society in these remote, very often remote locations. No right to work, nothing to do. And critically, the direct provision centres were run by private service providers, and that's maybe something we might like to come back to later.
For sure, yeah. And I understand that part of the issue was also that this accommodation didn't end up being temporary, even for asylum seekers, that some have been in those systems for years, as you said, excluded from work still until recently. And there's been a real issue with like the pace at which people weren't able to kind of get their claims processed and then be able to transition either into society or back to their countries of origin, depending on the results of their asylum claims.
Exactly. So while this system, you know, at best is an uncomfortable system that you might endure for, you know, maybe 6 months, in actual fact, what has ended up happening is that people have ended up in direct provision for years and years on end. So, for example, at the time of the McMahon review of the system of direct provision that happened in 2014, which was the first major sort of critical look at the system by the government, the McMahon review found that a third of protection applicants at that time had been in direct provision for 5 years or more. So rather than being a temporary system of asylum accommodation, it was actually an institutionalised, enforced system of congregated living for asylum seekers that was going on for years and years, that had kind of fairly profound physical and mental health repercussions for asylum seekers in the system.
And that's a great transition, because one of the things that I was hoping to talk about today was also the McMahon Working Group and the Day Working Group. So you were a part of the McMahon Working Group, yeah. Which was, as you said, in 2014, and then the Day Working Group was in 2019. And both, I understand, published reports with various recommendations. And so would you be able to outline, like, either from, you know, the version in 2014 or the later one, what some of those main recommendations were to change the system and how to improve these issues that you've mentioned?
Absolutely. So I might start with the McMahon Working Group, because that's the one I was involved in. So basically, even though there had been huge criticisms of direct provision, both by Irish bodies like the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission and other non-governmental organisations like the Irish Refugee Council, and also by UN bodies like the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, almost all the UN human rights treaty monitoring bodies had criticised direct provision. Nothing had happened for the first 14 years, and then eventually the government decided to establish a working group under the stewardship of former High Court judge and former University of Galway lecturer Brian McMahon to look at the system. Now, it's important to note what the remit of that working group was, because the working group was not allowed to suggest the abolition of direct provision, and that was made very clear in the terms of reference of the working group. So I can remember quite clearly the very first meeting of the working group. The minister at the time, Francis Fitzgerald, Minister of Justice and Equality at the time, basically gave us a fairly stark choice, which was either, you know, walk out now and don't be part of this working group because you object to the terms of reference and you want to see the abolition, the total abolition of direct provision, or be part of this system of change. But it has to change within the contours of the existing system. Another sort of problem with the McMahon Working Group was the fact that even though the working group was widely composed of civil society members, I was an academic, different government departments, the Legal Aid Board and so on, it had no direct asylum seeker representation on it. So it wasn't a perfect by any means, but still it was an exciting opportunity to be part of a reform discussion. So the McMahon Working Group made a whole series of recommendations about how direct provision could be improved, and also about how the asylum processing system could be speeded up. So on the improvement of direct provision, one of the critical issues was the overcrowding in direct provision, because single applicants were often accommodated in bedrooms that would be shared with 4, 6, or 8 other people. Families were often located in one room. But the accommodation was really confined to a bedroom, and there was no living accommodation. And food and meals were provided by the service provider, so there was no opportunity to cook. And that was a huge thing for applicants in direct provision, particularly families, because it was so inimical to family life that you wouldn't be able to cook and shop yourself. So the McMahon report made a number of recommendations about increasing the space, providing families in particular with some kind of living quarters as well as just a bedroom, ideally providing them with own door accommodation, and if not, providing them with a communal kitchen, for example, allowing individual applicants to apply for their own room after 9 months. So that was relating to the physical accommodation, but the report also made recommendations about the allowance, which was very, very low, and it made recommendations about how the weekly allowance should be increased, and also about how the system should be overseen, because there was no independent body with oversight over the direct provision accommodation. And what you had was the body in charge at the time was called the Reception and Integration Agency, and it had an internal complaints mechanism. But what applicants reported to the McMahon Group, and McMahon would have consulted widely with asylum seekers, was that if you made a complaint about your service provider, you would get moved, you'd get transferred to another location. So it was a kind of a punitive system. So McMahon also made a number of recommendations about bringing the direct provision under the auspices of the Ombudsman for Children, opening it up to HICWA inspections, having an independent, some kind of independent inspectorate to oversee it. So there was a number of recommendations made there too.
And so between, I mean, this report is published in 2015 or the end of 2014?
2015.
Yeah. So between then and when the next working group is established, were any of those recommendations kind of upheld by the government? Were there changes that were seen or not so much, which is what led to a kind of a very soon after another working group to look at the same issues?
So some of the issues were taken up by the government and some of them weren't. So in terms of the ones that were taken up, there was an increase in the allowance. There was some attempts to secure communal kitchen facilities, particularly for families. There was a better oversight and monitoring mechanisms put in place. There was, I kind of mentioned but didn't really go into it, there was a recommendation to streamline and improve the asylum decision-making procedure so that the process wouldn't take so long and people wouldn't be stuck in direct provision for so long. And indeed, there was a big attempt to speed up the asylum processing system and to regularise the status of people who were on deportation orders at that time, but who effectively couldn't be deported because it was impossible to deport them. So they were regularised. So there were some attempts made in that regard, but not all of the recommendations were implemented. For example, one of the key recommendations of the report was that asylum seekers should be entitled to work, because the deprivation of access to the labour market had really profound consequences for asylum seekers, because it really sealed their social exclusion from society. And with nowhere to go and no privacy, they were forced to stay in these reception centres all day long with nothing to do. And this had huge implications for people's mental health, as well as the atrophying of skills and the fact that when they did eventually get recognised, as some of them did, their skills and their qualifications were hopelessly out of date. So one of the key recommendations of McMahon was to enable asylum seekers to work. The government didn't accept this, and in fact it wasn't until a Supreme Court judgment in 2017 in a case called NHV versus Minister of Justice and Equality that that really the right to work became possible. The Supreme Court essentially said that it was unconstitutional to have a complete prohibition on the right to work for asylum seekers. And interestingly, it was the right to work issue that prevented Ireland from opting into an important EU directive that governs reception conditions for asylum seekers, which is the Reception Conditions Directive. And the fact that now the Supreme Court was mandating a right to work meant that Ireland was free to opt into the Reception Conditions Directive, which it did. And that also has repercussions on the system now, which we might talk about later.
Sure. Yeah. So there were, as you said, some changes made, but still some significant issues, which then leads to this second working group in 2019. Now, do you know, did they have the same kind of limits on their scope as before? Because obviously, as we'll get to after this working group, there is going to be the white paper that does recommend the end to direct provision as it's seen at the moment.
I suppose as a result of McMahon only being partially implemented, there was a certain momentum that was generated after McMahon, and a certain political acceptance that direct provision wasn't an acceptable way to treat people, particularly in the long term. And so in 2019, the government convened another expert group, an advisory expert group, which was chaired by Catherine Day, former Secretary General of the European Commission. And the Day report didn't have the same strictures. So they, in fact, recommended the complete abolition of direct provision in the sense of this, you know, segregated, congregated accommodation provided by private service providers. They recommended the complete abolition of that system and its replacement by something quite novel, actually. So they said that the state should build a number of state-owned reception centres where people would go for the initial 3 months of their asylum application. And then they would move to own-door accommodation after the first 3 months that would be sourced by local authorities. And that they would be fully recipients of social welfare, housing allowance, social welfare allowance. So they would come into the social welfare system, which they'd always been excluded from. And that there would be specialised supports provided to enable that transition. In moving to this new system, the Day Report advised that a whole of government approach would be necessary to abolish direct provision by 2024, meaning that it shouldn't be warehoused within one government department like the Department of Integration, but that there should be a cabinet committee composed of representatives of the different government departments, and that together they would forge a path out of direct provision. So it was a very exciting and novel report at the time, 2020. Unfortunately, that report was overtaken by events. So firstly by COVID and then by various other events that we can discuss.
For sure, yeah. And so that's my understanding, is that there was, kind of some hope that this paper, the white paper, is published by the government in 2021 saying, okay, direct provision will be abolished by 2024. As you outlined, some, you know, exciting changes in terms of moving away from this private for-profit system and, ensuring that people are better integrated into the community within a shorter amount of time. But there were some issues, obviously, with how the white paper was formulated, as we've kind of seen with the current events, in part that it was kind of designed for about 3,500 asylum seekers per year to arrive in Ireland. And between the war between Ukraine and Russia and then post-COVID numbers of asylum seekers arriving in Ireland, we've been seeing more like 13,000 applicants a year, which is in part some of the issues that the government's now faced, not being able to end direct provision as quickly as they intended.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the landscape radically changed in a way that really couldn't have been foreseen by the Day Report. So, as you said, the Day Report envisaged its blueprint as being based on 3,500 applications, asylum applications every year. And now what it didn't foresee was a couple of things. So first of all, the Irish housing crisis, which has been caused by structural problems within the Irish housing market. And just to give a flavour of what that crisis means, there's about 58,000 people on the housing waiting list at the moment. So there are 58,000 homeless Irish people on the housing waiting list. Also, as you say, huge increase in the number of asylum seekers. So it had fluctuated somewhere between 1.5 and about 5,000 per year from 2016 to 2021. So that's where Day was basing her estimate of about 3,500 a year. But then in 2022, the numbers jumped hugely to over 13,000 asylum applicants. And in 2023, they were also in excess of 13,000, which is a huge leap. But just to put it in context, still only about 1.4% of asylum applications that are received in the EU every year. So not in any sense a large overall number of asylum applicants, but certainly a huge leap compared to what Ireland was used to receiving. Now, I would make a little bit of a link with the early noughties. So in roughly around 2002, 2003, we did have an excess of 12,000 asylum applicants annually. So we have been here before, but it certainly was unexpected that the numbers would go up so dramatically. And then add to that the Ukrainian caseload of over 100,000 Ukrainians, which have come in under a separate system, which is the EU Temporary Protection Directive. And that directive was activated, even though it's on the statute book since 2001, it was only activated for the first time in response to the Ukrainian caseload. And it allows Ukrainians to come into the different EU member states, whichever EU member state they wish to, actually. And they are treated in Ireland under the normal social welfare system, and they're entitled to accommodation. And generally speaking, that accommodation has been provided in hotels and so on. Yeah. So the Ukrainian caseload came in. There was a huge increase in the number of asylum seekers. There was the Irish housing crisis. So it was almost like a perfect storm, if you can imagine that, to disrupt the day blueprint.
Yeah, and it seems like the government kind of just ended up in this perpetual like crisis mode almost. Like they couldn't kind of get ahead of the situation as it unfolded. And especially of late, it seems like it's really the last several months that these issues seem to have kind of exploded in the country. In December, the government announcing that, you know, they no longer had spaces, or they couldn't guarantee spaces for male asylum seekers anymore, just because of a lack of beds. At present, I think the most recent numbers, 750 male asylum seekers who haven't been accommodated, who are living on the streets or wherever else they can find accommodation. So, I mean, to me, this was a bit remarkable to read. It's rare, I think, you have at least such candor in the government to admit readily, you know, we're going to give out tents and sleeping bags because we just can't find the space. So what were your thoughts was this something that was expected? Did people see this coming, or was it a surprise to kind of see that like things had gotten so bad that there was so little space, or that the government, you know, hadn't been able to find the spaces as the case might be?
I mean, it was certainly the Irish housing crisis has been creeping up on us for over a decade. The increase in asylum seekers in the Ukrainian caseload wasn't foreseen, to be fair. Having said that, you know, the crisis narrative has always been with us. And, you know, we need to remember that direct provision itself was introduced to a crisis narrative back in 2000. So this idea of a crisis and being overrun by asylum seekers has always been there and being carefully crafted by the government, in fact. And at the same time, I would say that the government has always been unwilling to squarely face this issue. I mean, we have had, you know, these two major reports, McMahon and Day, and yet we haven't seen any real attempt to dismantle the direct provision system. And I think there's always been a kind of a belief in government. And I'm not just referring to a single government, because obviously successive governments have been in power since 2000. There's a kind of a belief that if you treat asylum seekers badly, that will be, you know, a deterrent to their arrival. And there's this kind of narrative or belief that asylum seekers are somehow an aberration and that they'll stop coming at some point. And there's been a lack of squarely facing up to the reality that asylum is going to be a permanent feature of the landscape, not just in Ireland, in all countries of the world. I was going to say in all industrialized countries, but of course the vast majority of asylum seekers are hosted in developing countries. So asylum is a byproduct of human rights violations, it's a byproduct of war, it's a byproduct of climate change and social inequality and poverty and so forth. So this is a permanent feature of the landscape, and the government has never, I think, fully accepted the permanency of this phenomenon and the fact that it's necessary to put permanent solutions as opposed to ad hoc crisis-related solutions in place.
Yeah, this was going to be one of the questions I had, because it seems like they've been kind of scrambling to find any additional spaces they can. And as a result, there have been all these you know, reports of different protests around the countries from communities who have said in various ways that they've been a bit fed up with how the situation is being managed. Of course, there's different threads within that with relation to, you know, a bit of anti-asylum rhetoric and obviously other groups that are probably capitalizing on an unfortunate situation in general. So not to paint everyone who might be protesting with the same type of brush. But are there things that the government, you know, could be doing better in terms of they're in this situation, obviously they need to get out of the immediate issue of saying they have no more spaces available, but to do so in a way that doesn't kind of allow the population to turn into a, you know, thinking that asylum is the issue rather than perhaps the structures in place or the organization around it from the government side?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, here it's important to go back to the kind of root causes of the problem. So we just park the Irish homelessness problem for a moment. That's not the cause of the problems with indirect provision or the problems of homeless asylum seekers. The problem really is that it's the government is reliant on private service providers to provide direct provision accommodation, and therefore they're reliant on the market. And the market simply cannot provide at the moment because of the Irish homelessness crisis and other factors, including, you know, the Ukrainian caseload. So actually, much more asylum seekers at the moment are in emergency accommodation than in direct provision. And then, you know, some are in tented accommodation, a couple, you know, some are in these two state-owned accommodation centres. One is in City West and the other is in Balseskin. But most asylum seekers are actually in emergency accommodation, or a significant number. Actually, I looked up the number. It's 834 are now rough sleeping. So obviously that needs to be dealt with. Now, it needs to be dealt with in the long term, but it also needs to be dealt with in the short term. Long term solutions to this, and we can talk about them later, are being planned for, but they're not going to be ready to be rolled out anytime soon. So we need to think about how we're going to deal with the immediate crisis of accommodation and how we're going to work with local communities. And in this regard, I just want to point back to, because again, none of these problems are actually really new. The government has always eschewed talking to local populations. When direct provision centres are opened under this policy of dispersal that was introduced in 2000, people were always sort of just parachuted in, an accommodation centre would open and nobody would be consulted. And it was almost like the government thought, well, local communities are not going to like asylum seekers, so we better just get them in there and, you know, without consulting local communities. So no benefit of the doubt was ever given to local communities that they might like to be involved somehow, or they might have some solutions to offer. And so there's been a complete lack of consultation with local communities about, you know, setting up new asylum accommodation centres. So we've seen this in County Galway, we've seen it in Roscrea recently, we've seen it all around the country where, hotels, for example, are repurposed within the space of a week or 2 weeks to accommodate asylum seekers with no consultation with the local community, or else the local community is presented with a complete fait accompli that they have no input into. And it's not surprising that local communities who are already struggling for resources, and again, a separate issue, they don't have enough GPs, they don't have enough school places, or maybe they don't have enough specialist language teachers to help with the Ukrainian caseload that's already in their towns. They're struggling for resources already. And so, unsurprisingly, really, they perceive the arrival of these new asylum seekers as putting a strain on already existing strained resources.
And in terms of the efforts that the government has done so far, I know you've been involved like the last month or so quite heavily in different media sources kind of giving information and trying to help clear up these narratives about asylum. And there have been some efforts from the government, or purported efforts, but, you know, to say they're going to look into what additional supports are required and trying to calm down communities and making it clear that Ireland is still open to asylum seekers and the like. But do you think that enough is being done from the government side to kind of make it clear that they're making an effort to change their approach, or not so much at the moment?
Well, unfortunately, the whole issue now has assumed these really sort of right-wing tones. So the thing has bitten the government in the tail, because it's now become a really politically unpopular issue. Whereas if, you know, this had been dealt with, if direct provision had really been tackled in a timely manner, we arguably wouldn't be where we are. But look, we are here, so we have to deal with it now. Apparently, within the Department of Integration, they have created a community engagement team that is set to go out and talk to local communities in advance. And I'm not sure exactly what the remit of that team is, but if I were designing it, I think I would be going out and asking local communities what it is they need. So what would be the quid pro quo in their view? Which is not to say that they get a veto over asylum reception centres, but at least that they could say, well, we need another GP, or we need another SNA in the school, or we need a new teacher, or we need more guards, or whatever it might be, that there would be a genuine process of consultation and negotiation. And of course, negotiation means that, you know, both sides of the negotiation have to be prepared to concede something, and neither side is going to get everything. That's the nature of negotiation. So I think local communities and this new team have to negotiate with each other in good faith, to to be ready to accommodate asylum seekers. But unfortunately, also what we've seen from government is kind of buying into this kind of far-right narrative that the Irish asylum system is being overrun with bogus applicants. And there really isn't much evidence of this. So we see the government sort of defending its record on asylum, saying that it has, you know, rigorous screening mechanisms in place, that it's has a safe country list, a safe country of origin list, and a fast track procedure for sending people pretty quickly back to their countries of origin if they're deemed to be objectively safe. And a number of new countries have been added to that list recently. And, you know, ministers, including the Taoiseach, coming out and saying, you know, Ireland welcomes genuine asylum seekers, but not the other crew, as if there was a watertight sort of distinction between what is a genuine asylum seeker and what is not. And the thing I think that people don't realise is that you can have genuine protection reasons for being in Ireland and for seeking asylum, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be recognised as a refugee, because the refugee definition is extremely narrow. And many people who are fleeing quite serious human rights violations and war situations might not actually get recognised as refugees in Ireland. That doesn't mean they're bogus, though. And in fact, I would go so far as to say even economic migrants aren't bogus as such, because there's no watertight compartmentalisation of what is an economic migrant and what is an asylum seeker. Because if you're in a war-type situation, for example, or a situation where there's, you know, low-lying civil insurgency, that country is probably going to be quite impoverished. So you might be motivated by economic motivations as well to seek a better life elsewhere, but there might also be protection concerns. Or you might be fleeing for your life and you might stop and think, OK, well, where am I going to go? And what country can I go to that will secure me the best prospects of integration and a job? And where is there a diaspora that comes from my country? So all these kind of fairly practical economic considerations can coexist with a very valid asylum claim. So there isn't these two entirely separate categories of economic migrant and asylum seeker. And this is something that should be appreciated, I think, by an Irish audience and an Irish government, given the sheer number of Irish economic migrants. I mean, we tend nowadays to call them expatriates, but, you know, who doesn't know somebody who's been to Australia or the United States or some other country or is exercising EU free movement rights? They're also economic migrants. It's not a bad word. And that's before we even look into the historical migration in the 50s and, of course, back to famine times with the famine ships going to the United States. So we have a very long history of economic emigration ourselves. So we should be well placed to understand the plight of the economic migrant.
And I think also, you know, important to note, I've read quite extensively that a lot of, you know, healthcare workers and such in Ireland, there's also a lot of, you know, immigration to Ireland, which is supporting the economy in various ways. So, you know, it's complicated in general, just painting it as kind of a negative or positive if someone is moving somewhere for economic reasons, not necessarily that simple as it is. But I've also heard you talk quite extensively about this idea of illegal immigrants and how labeling people as illegal if they come without a passport or without a valid visa or something of the like is really just an unfair characterization, because there are no legal measures for a humanitarian type of flee to Ireland. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, amongst this, what I would term quite right-wing rhetoric by certain members of the government and also wider society is this idea that legal migrants are fine, but illegal or irregular migrants or asylum seekers are not, which kind of creates the impression that there is some regular route as an asylum seeker that you can come in here. But of course, that's not the case, because if you come from what we call an asylum producing country, almost invariably that country will be placed on a visa blacklist, with the emphasis on the word black. So asylum producing countries are on a visa blacklist. If you are an asylum seeker and you're trying to come to Ireland from one of those countries, you kind of try to apply for a visa if you want, but almost invariably you won't get one. And also, asylum producing countries tend to be countries that are immersed in conflict or other very serious human rights violations. And they don't tend to be countries that have an established rule of law with government departments that produce things like passports. So very often it's not possible for people to, you know, apply to the government for passports. Afghanistan would be a really good case in point there. Also, if people are fleeing, there's no time to get these documents in order as well. So, you know, when people are fleeing persecution or human rights violations, it's often, you know, a split second life or death decision to flee. And there's no time to get these kind of documents in order, even if they were readily available, which they're not. So it's actually really difficult to come in through legal means. And that explains why people have to rely on false or fraudulent documents that are provided by smugglers, for example, or indeed because it's actually really difficult, quite difficult to get in on those type of documents now because of biometric identifiers and so on. People are increasingly relying on, you know, getting into flimsy boats to cross the Mediterranean or to cross the Channel, or the back of lorries into containers and so on. So really life-threatening ways. And that just shows the desperation of people. People wouldn't do these things unless they were an absolute last resort, which just goes to show that there is no regular route. There's really no such thing as a humanitarian visa. I mean, we've had a couple of instances. We had a small program of humanitarian visas for high-profile Afghan human rights defenders when the Taliban took over in 2001 or in 2021. But normally there's no such thing as a humanitarian visa. So it's just not possible to come through regular means.
For sure. No, and I think it's important that, you know, people kind of keep that in mind when we're looking at the larger situation and the rhetoric that we're hearing from various sides. But turning things back to the accommodation crisis as it is at the moment, and we discussed earlier, you know, there are some emergency things that kind of need to be done at the moment to try to secure additional accommodation, additional spaces in beds. I've read some reports from the media indicating that there might be additional spaces within existing accommodation that maybe isn't being managed, the stock isn't being managed appropriately, that there might be unused spaces, or there might be unused government buildings that could be quickly transitioned. Are there any other emergency measures that could be employed at the moment to kind of secure those additional spaces to get people off the streets immediately?
Well, a complete review of the stock is absolutely essential. I've heard, but I don't know if it's true or not, but I've sort of heard on the grapevine that accommodation isn't in fact at capacity. So here again, this is the problem with subcontracting out the issue to private service providers, because the government isn't essentially in charge. But I would think a complete audit is necessary. Perhaps it's already happened, I'm not sure, of available accommodation spaces. And then the use of emergency powers is another thing that the government could bypass sort of regular planning laws to establish perhaps modular accommodation, as we have done in response to the Irish homelessness crisis. So that's another option. Engaging with local communities, we've already spoken about, and then completely clamping down on, you know, on arson has to be a huge, a big response. I mean, we've seen really soft touch policing of this kind of hard right militant elements and local communities that are actively protesting outside accommodation centres and blocking the entrance to accommodation centres. And bearing in mind that that's private property, you know, those are offences. Those are criminal offences we're talking about, even when it's short of arson. But of course, arson raises the issue, why were those various places not being properly protected and policed, either by private security firms or by the Gardaí? You know, if it's known that an accommodation centre is going to be repurposed, well, then immediately it needs to be secured. And then the guards need to follow up very heavily. And I know that they are doing, but still we've seen nothing happening by way of court cases yet, to my knowledge, in response to the arson attacks that have been ongoing.
Yeah, and in a case where you're this pressed for space, it kind of seems like every building counts, and, you know, you might lose 20 spaces, let's say, in an arson, and every one of those are people that are not going to get accommodation in the short term. So it's quite problematic that this has been occurring, especially in the last 3 months or so, but even before that, I think since 2018, there have been reported cases of
of arsons on these locations.
Now, it does seem that the arson attacks are, you know, kind of ad hoc attacks, quite organic and possibly coming from local communities themselves. But it's clear, and even the residents in Ross Grey who were protesting against asylum seekers said this, that, you know, these types of protests do attract far-right elements. Now, in the case of Ross Grey, I think they got fairly short shrift, but it just goes to show that there is this hard right cohort out there that's willing to capitalize and exploit on the legitimate fears of local communities to their own ends, to really stoke up fears about asylum seekers. So we've heard, for example, this narrative about the male unvetted military aged asylum seeker, you know, and that's just a way of a clever far right way of framing the issue and encouraging people to be anxious and scared of asylum seekers. You know, military aged asylum seeking men are also like gardening aged asylum seekers. They're also Domino's pizza aged asylum seekers. They're also healthcare aged asylum seeking men. So it just depends on how you construe this group. You know, the fact that they're young men doesn't mean that they're any less vulnerable than any other cohort of asylum seekers. In fact, we know very often men are, you know, portrayed as being, you know, resourceful, self-sufficient, reliant, and so on. But from everything we know about the journey that they're likely to have undertaken at the hands of smugglers very often, is that they will have been through some very severe human rights violations en route to get to Ireland. So portraying them as this, you know, robust population that isn't in, that's well able to fend for themselves is just a myth. Many of these people are extremely vulnerable and in need of state assistance.
And they don't quite fit this narrative of, you know, like a woman or a child or someone who is typically what is portrayed as a very vulnerable individual, which is perhaps why people are able to exploit this slightly more, because it's easier for them to kind of continue in that train of thought, just because it fits into, you know, innate kind of biases that people have.
Absolutely. But also some of them are children, actually. So there was a case taken last year in the High Court in 2023 in April. By an unaccompanied minor who had been wrongly age assessed as being an adult, and he took a case to the High Court challenging his homelessness and the failure of the state to provide him with accommodation. And he based his legal challenge on the EU Recast Reception Conditions Directive, which is that directive that Ireland opted into after the Supreme Court basically said that asylum seekers were allowed to work. So Ireland did opt into that directive. And that directive provides that asylum seekers have to be accommodated and provided with basic means of subsistence. So this unaccompanied minor asylum seeker challenged his homelessness and he won his case. And the High Court basically said that the state was in violation of the Reception Conditions Directive. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is because he was in actual fact an unaccompanied minor. So that just goes to show how, even though we might consider that it's only men that are being rendered homeless and having to sleep rough, it's not just men. And also, but the larger, I suppose, point is that this creation of these hierarchies of need is really objectionable, because in essence, all asylum seekers, because of what they've been through already in their countries of origin and en route, are inherently vulnerable. And creating a kind of hierarchy of vulnerability based on factors like your gender or, you know, your age or whether you are a victim of trafficking or whatever it might be, is it's really a crude way of measuring vulnerability. Really, we can only measure somebody's vulnerability on the basis of an individualized assessment. And anyone can be vulnerable depending on what they've been through and their predispositions and their psychological makeup and their physical makeup. So it's not possible to say with any degree of certainty that all women are vulnerable and all men aren't, for example, because that's a matter of assessment.
And I'm glad you brought up that case, because kind of turning to more of a legal and human rights perspective of the ongoing issues, I understand that the High Court has also granted the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission leave to judicially review the Minister of Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth. Quite a long title every time you have to say that. Basically that IRAC is looking for kind of a legal action to compel the state to fulfill their obligations with regards to providing for the basic needs of asylum seekers, including accommodation. and looking for a high court declaration that the failure to provide for these basic needs is a breach of their human rights. So what are your thoughts on these ongoing legal proceedings? Is there any hope that this will actually kind of change the situation, or is it going to be, you know, too slow, too late, considering the contemporary issues?
Look, IRAC has been involved, actually was involved in that case. Skip put in an amicus curiae brief to that case, SY versus Minister of Integration, last year. So they've been involved in this issue for a long time, and I'm glad to hear that their involvement is ongoing. But I think the government is just going to simply say, well, we don't have the resources to provide this, so it's completely out of our hands. Now, another thing that could be considered, actually, and I don't know whether it is being considered, is to do a preliminary reference to the Court of Justice of the EU, because, of course, Ireland is in violation of the EU Reception Conditions Directive, and hence it's in violation of EU law. So that would be another possibility, or to make to lobby the European Commission to take proceedings, infringement proceedings against Ireland on the basis of the violation of the Recast Reception Conditions Directive. Now, the Commission has been particularly weak in following up with states about violations of the Reception Conditions Directive, possibly because Ireland is not unique in this regard. There are many, actually, EU member states where homelessness amongst the asylum population is pretty rife. And so it may well be that the Commission is taking a political calculation that there's no point in following up. But here, the Commission is in violation of its own obligation as guardian of the treaties and guardian of EU law, and by not following up in response to member states' flagrant violation of EU law.
So it seems like, regardless, it might be something that could occur in the future, but in the present might not be what kind of changes the situation as it is. And I guess, like, turning back to what some of these longer term solutions might be, or longer term actions that the government can take. We've discussed the fact that, you know, you really need to turn away from this private provision of accommodation, and a turn towards some sort of not-for-profit structure or government-run structure. Obviously complicated to accomplish, especially as it's been a couple of years since these recommendations have come out and there hasn't been significant progress towards that. So what do you think needs to be done kind of as these first steps to be able to transition away from the direct provision system long term?
Yeah. Well, what's being talked about at the moment is a revised white paper. We've yet to see this. The government seems to be talking about 6 new reception and integration centres that would house asylum seekers. I'm not sure, is this building upon day? Is this going to be 6 reception centres for an initial period, and then they're, you know, then asylum seekers would fall under the local authorities? That doesn't seem to be a sustainable or viable solution to me. So maybe these 6 reception centres are meant to be permanent asylum and integration centres where asylum seekers would stay for the duration of the asylum process. It's unclear whether they're going to be purpose-built or whether they're going to be repurposed existing state accommodation. But the proposal seems to be that these would be state-owned, and that they would be run by housing associations. So housing associations would be like registered charities, like, for example, Respond or Cluid or one of these charitable housing associations. So would they be run by housing associations as opposed to private service providers? I'm guessing that they would. But these housing associations, they would still have to tender for these contracts. And of course, if the state was basing its tendering on cost alone, the temptation would be to give the tender to the housing association that has provides the best value for money. And then I would ask, well, what's the difference between that and a private service provider? Because some of the criticisms of direct provision relate to overcrowding, they relate to poor quality of food and lack of living space and so on. Whereas if you have a housing association that has to cut costs to come in with a viable tender, then those types of temptations, that low-hanging fruit, would be there for them too. So it's hard to see how this would result in an improvement in the standards within these reception centres. So I would have question marks. I mean, obviously it's to be welcomed, a shift from private service providers to housing associations is on the face of it a good thing. But you'd have to drill down into that and into the type of tendering to see whether it was. And maybe there's a role for the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission here to human rights proof the tendering process to make sure that the tendering is not just a function of cost, but also takes into consideration human rights concerns. And I suppose I would just add to that that, you know, Ireland doesn't have a great record of institutionalised care. So when we look back on, you know, reformatories and mother and baby homes and so on, so Magdalen laundries and so forth. So really, I think it would need to be very, very carefully planned about the management and running of these centres. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about how to avoid segregation within those centres as well.
For sure, yeah.
So I'm just trying to envisage six centres. Where would they be located? I mean, we can't have a system like we have currently where, you know, emergency accommodation pops up in the most bizarre and rural of locations. For example, the Rosslake House Hotel, which was burnt down in the arson attack in County Galway. I mean, you can't envisage how rural this place is. It's, you know, it's about 3 kilometres off the main road between Moycullen and Uachtaráid. It's as remote and it's inaccessible, you know, as it's possible to get. So obviously these major reception centres will have to be located in urban populations, whether they're towns or cities or whatever it might be. And then the question is, how do you avoid segregating this community from the local population? And how do you get the buy-in of the local community? And here I think we need really blue sky thinking that we haven't seen to date. Things like, could we co-locate community services within these reception centres? Services like, for example, creches and Montessoris that would also be open to the local population as well as the asylum seeker population. Could we have community centres within these reception centres for the use of the local population, where the local sports clubs could have their premises, where you could have the men's shed, for example, or the local history society or whatever it might be? Could you have health centres within these reception centres that would be open to the whole population? So primary healthcare, playgrounds, small commercial centres like shops and hairdressers and so forth. So how could you create these reception centres in a way that they benefit not only the asylum population, but also the local community? And you could have fluid movement of asylum seekers and the local community in and out of these reception centres. And here I think we have a lot to learn from the African context, where very often in Africa, refugee protection is provided in refugee camps. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have refugee camps, but what they've learned from the African context is that if you segregate the refugee camp from the local community and you provide services within the refugee camp that aren't available to the local community, that you're only going to stoke tension and racism and xenophobia. Whereas where you open the refugee camp to the local community and locate services within the refugee camp, this is a good way to avoid those things and also to promote integration and mutual respect amongst the two different communities.
And this would also, I assume, you know, contribute to this change in narrative, because the more persons interact, then the less they're able to just believe what they're told based on no kind of personal experience with asylum seekers or the like. And I think it's interesting because there's been such a welcoming, it seems, of Ukrainians in terms of the emergency situations they faced and the temporary protection they've needed, even welcoming Ukrainians into homestays and sharing accommodation and the like. And it's just curious to me that there seems to be, like, there's such a different view of asylum seekers or international protection applicants compared to Ukrainian arrivals. And is there a way that we can kind of see people just as more of a collective rather than, you know, having these different groupings, Ukrainians getting protection in this way, asylum seekers getting it in this way, and not having kind of community shared in the way that you're envisaging?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an interesting piece of research to be done on the differential attitudes of politicians and people in response to the Ukrainian crisis and other crises, like the Syrian crisis in 2015, for example, which elicited a very different type of response. Why is it that Ukrainians are more welcome, for example? Is it because the war is more readily understandable because the war is in Europe and it's the first you know, international war in Europe since the Second World War? Is it that, you know, it we have a common enemy, you know, a kind of a an archetypal bad guy in the form of Putin? Is it that Ukrainians are white and Christian? What are the factors that have led us to be so welcoming of Ukrainians? And of course, let's not overstate it as well. That welcome might start to dry up. Not that I'm suggesting it should. Of course, it shouldn't, but that might well happen. But also, apart from that, I would sort of take exception to this idea that Irish society, by and large, is not welcoming to asylum seekers, because, you know, these protests outside reception centres and the kind of rise of the far right gives the impression that Ireland is really unwelcoming. And I'm not sure that that's actually true. It's just that these are headline grabbing media sensational type stories that tend to get the attention of everybody. Whereas in actual fact, there are, you know, so many thousands asylum seekers and recognised refugees that are well integrated into Ireland, that have been welcomed by local communities, that are a pillar of the local community now, and that there have been absolutely no problems, or the problems insofar as they have arisen have been adequately dealt with. It's just that we don't hear so much about these success stories because, you know, they're not as sort of sexy as the stories of conflagrations and violence and animosity. So I do think that, you know, there's a lot of research actually needs to be done on Irish communities' welcome to asylum seekers.
And that's probably a good place for us to start wrapping up on a more positive note of, you know, hopefully things are much more welcoming than they might appear in some of these media headlines. But I guess before we do our final, you know, outro, is there anything that we're missing from today's discussion that we haven't covered on, or something that's important for people to kind of take away from today's discussion, that the most important bit, if they only remember one thing from it?
Oh, that's a nice question. I suppose I would say that asylum seekers are kind of pawns in all this. I don't mean to suggest that, you know, they have no agency, but asylum seekers are not the cause of this problem, although they are really feeling the brunt of it. This problem is caused and has been caused by decades of governmental neglect. And that neglect has now given space to the rise of the far right in Ireland and is biting the government in the tail, because it's really hard now to get on top of this problem and to get ahead of this problem, as you said. So, I mean, I think what we really need to be doing in the run-up to elections is to be asking our government representatives about their practical solutions for dealing with this. And when I talk about practical solutions, I mean long-term viable solutions. I don't mean ad hoc solutions to this particular crisis. I mean a real squaring up to the fact that this issue is a permanent feature of the landscape and needs a permanent solution.
Kira, thank you so much for joining me for today's discussion. Obviously a very complicated issue with lots of moving parts at any given time, but I think you've done a great job in providing the overview and the clarity that we've been looking for to kind of understand the situation as it stands and what we can kind of hope for moving forward.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway and supported by the University Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning.